Chapter 2. It was a summer of wisteria. The twilight was full of it, and of the smell of his father's cigar as they sat on the front gallery after supper until it would be time for Quentin to start. While in the deep, shaggy lawn below the veranda, the fireflies blew and drifted in soft random. The odor, the scent, which 5 months later Mr. Compson's letter would carry up from Mississippi and over the long iron New England snow and into Quentin's sitting room at Harvard. It was a day of listening, too. The listening, the hearing in 1909, even yet, mostly that which he already knew, since he had been born in and still breathed the same air in which the church bells had rung on that Sunday morning in 1833. And on Sundays heard even one of the original three bells in the same steeple where descendants of the same pigeons strutted and crooned or wheeled in short courses resembling soft, fluid paint smears on the soft summer sky. A Sunday morning in June, with the bells ringing peaceful and peremptory and a little cacophonous, the denominations in concord, though not in tune, and the ladies and children, and house negroes to carry the parasols and fly whisks, and even a few men, the ladies moving in hoops among the miniature broadcloth of little boys and the pantalettes of little girls, in the skirts of the time when ladies did not walk but floated, when the other men, sitting with their feet on the railing of the Holston House gallery, looked up, and there the stranger was. He was already halfway across the square when they saw him, on a hard-ridden roan horse, man and beast looking as though they had been created out of thin air and set down in the bright summer Sabbath sunshine in the middle of a tired foxtrot. Face and horse that none of them had ever seen before, name that none of them had ever heard, and origin and purpose which some of them were never to learn. So that in the next 4 weeks, Jefferson was a village then, the Holston House, the courthouse, six stores, a blacksmith and livery stable, a saloon frequented by drovers and peddlers, three churches and perhaps 30 residences. The stranger's name went back and forth among the places of business and of idleness, and among the residences, in steady strophe and antistrophe. Sutphen, 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 Sutphen. That was all that the town was to know about him for almost a month. He had apparently come into town from the south, a man of about 25, as the town learned later, because at the time his age could not have been guessed, because at that time he looked like a man who had been sick, not like a man who had been peacefully ill in bed and had recovered to move with a sort of diffident and tentative amazement in a world which he had believed himself on the point of surrendering, but like a man who had been through some solitary furnace experience which was more than just fever, like an explorer, say, who not only had to face the normal hardship of the pursuit which he chose, but was overtaken by the added and unforeseen handicap of the fever also, and fought through it at enormous cost, not so much physical as mental, alone and unaided, and not through blind instinctive will to endure and survive, but to gain and keep to enjoy it the material prize for which he accepted the original gambit. A man with a big frame, but gaunt now, almost to emaciation, with a short reddish beard which resembled a disguise, and above which his pale eyes had a quality at once visionary and alert, ruthless and reposed, in a face whose flesh had the appearance of pottery, of having been colored by that oven's fever either of soul or environment, deeper than sun alone beneath a dead impervious surface as of glazed clay. That was what they saw, though it was years before the town learned that that was all which he possessed at the time. The strong, spent horse, and the clothes on his back, and a small saddlebag scarcely large enough to contain the spare linen and the razors, and the two pistols of which Miss Coldfield told Quentin, with the butts worn smooth as pick-handles, and which he used with the precision of knitting needles. Later, Quentin's grandfather saw him ride at a canter around a sapling at 20 feet, and put both bullets into a playing card fastened to the tree. He had a room in the Holston House, but he carried the key with him, and each morning he fed and saddled the horse and rode away before daylight, whereto the town likewise failed to learn, probably due to the fact that he gave the pistol demonstration on the third day after his arrival. So they had to depend on inquiry to find out what they could about him, which would of necessity be at night, at the supper table in the Holston House dining room, or in the lounge which he would have to cross to gain his room and lock the door again, which he would do as soon as he finished eating. The bar opened into the lounge, too, and that would or should have been the place to accost him and even inquire, except for the fact that he did not use the bar. He did not drink at all, he told them. He did not say that he used to drink and had quit, nor that he had never used alcohol. He just said that he would not care for a drink. It was years later before even Quentin's grandfather, he was a young man too then, it would be years yet before he would become General Compson, learned that the reason Sutphen did not drink was that he did not have the money with which to pay his share or return the courtesy. It was General Compson who first realized that at this time Sutphen lacked not only the money to spend for drink and conviviality, but the time and inclination as well. That he was at this time completely the slave of his secret and furious impatience, his conviction gained from whatever that recent experience had been, that fever, mental or physical, of a need for haste, of time fleeing beneath him, which was to drive him for the next 5 years, as General Compson computed it, roughly until about 9 months before his son was born. So they would catch him, run him to earth in the lounge between the supper table and his locked door to give him the opportunity to tell them who he was and where he came from and what he was up to, whereupon he would move gradually and steadily until his back came in contact with something, a post or a wall, and then stand there and tell them nothing whatever as pleasantly and courteously as a hotel clerk. It was the Chickasaw Indian agent with or through whom he dealt, and so it was not until he waked the county recorder that Saturday night with the deed, patent to the land, and the gold Spanish coin, that the town learned that he now owned 100 square miles of some of the best virgin bottom land in the country, though even that knowledge came too late, because Sutphen himself was gone, where to again they did not know. But he owned land among them now, and some of them began to suspect what General Compson apparently knew, that the Spanish coin with which he had paid to have his patent recorded was the last one of any kind which he possessed. So they were certain now that he had departed to get more. There were several who even anticipated in believing, and even in saying aloud now that he was not present, what Sutphen's future and then unborn sister-in-law was to tell Quentin almost 8 years later, that he had found some unique and practical way of hiding loot, and that he had returned to the cache to replenish his pockets, even if he had not actually ridden with the 2 pistols back to the river and the steamboats full of gamblers and cotton and slave dealers to replenish the cache. At least some of them were telling one another that when 2 months later he returned, again without warning and accompanied this time by the covered wagon with a Negro driving it, and on the seat with the Negro, a small, alertly resigned man with a grim, harried Latin face, in a frock coat and a flowered waistcoat and a hat which would have created no furor on a Paris boulevard, all of which he was to wear constantly for the next 2 years, the somberly theatric clothing and the expression of fatalistic and amazed determination, while his white client and the Negro crew, which he was to advise, though not direct, went stark naked save for a coating of dried mud. This was the French architect. Years later the town learned that he had come all the way from Martinique on Sutphen's bare promise, and lived for 2 years on venison cooked over a campfire, in an unfloored tent made of the wagon hood, before he so much as saw any color or shape of pay. And until he passed through town on his way back to New Orleans 2 years later, he was not even to see Jefferson again. He would not come, or Sutphen would not bring him, to town, even on the few occasions when Sutphen would be seen there, and he did not have much chance to look at Jefferson on that first day because the wagon did not stop. Apparently it was only by sheer geographical hap that Sutphen passed through town at all, pausing only long enough for someone, not General Compson, to look beneath the wagon hood and into a black tunnel filled with still eyeballs and smelling like a wolf den. But the legend of Sutphen's wild Negroes was not to begin at once, because the wagon went on as though even the wood and iron which composed it, as well as the mules which drew it, had become imbued by sheer association with him with that quality of gaunt and tireless driving, that conviction for haste and of fleeing time. Later, Sutphen told Quentin's grandfather that on that afternoon when the wagon passed through Jefferson, they had been without food since the previous night, and that he was trying to reach Sutphen's 100 in the river bottom to try to kill a deer before dark, so he and the architect and the Negroes would not have to spend another night without food. So the legend of the wild men came gradually back to town, brought by the men who would ride out to watch what was going on, who began to tell how Sutphen would take stand beside a game trail with the pistols and send the Negroes in to drive the swamp like a pack of hounds. It was they who told how, during that first summer and fall, the Negroes did not even have, or did not use, blankets to sleep in, even before the coon hunter Acres claimed to have walked one of them out of the absolute mud like a sleeping alligator and screamed just in time. The Negroes could speak no English yet, and doubtless there were more than Acres who did not know that the language in which they and Sutphen communicated was a sort of French, and not some dark and fatal tongue of their own. There were many more than Acres, though the others were responsible citizens and landowners, and so did not have to lurk about the camp at night. In fact, as Miss Coldfield told Quentin, they would make up parties to meet at the Holston house and go out horseback, often carrying lunch. Sutphen had built a brick kiln, and he had set up the saw and planer which he had brought in the wagon, a capstan with a long sapling walking beam, with the wagon team and the Negroes in shifts, and himself too when necessary, when the machinery slowed, hitched to it. As if the Negroes actually were wild men. As General Compson told his son, Quentin's father, while the Negroes were working, Sutphen never raised his voice at them, that instead he led them, caught them at the psychological instant by example, by some ascendancy of forbearance rather than by brute fear. Without dismounting, usually Sutphen did not even greet them with as much as a nod, apparently as unaware of their presence as if they had been idle shades. They would sit in a curious quiet clump as though for mutual protection, and watch his mansion rise, carried plank by plank and brick by brick out of the swamp where the clay and timber waited. The bearded white man and the 20 black ones and all stark naked beneath the croaching and pervading mud. Being men, these spectators did not realize that the garments which Sutphen had worn when he first rode into Jefferson were the only ones in which they had ever seen him, and few of the women in the county had seen him at all yet. Otherwise, some of them would have anticipated Miss Coldfield in this too. In divining that he was saving his clothes, since decorum, even if not elegance of appearance, would be the only weapon, or rather ladder, with which he could conduct the last assault upon what Miss Coldfield and perhaps others believed to be respectability. That respectability which, according to General Compson, consisted in Sutphen's secret mind of a great deal more than the mere acquisition of a chatelaine for his house. So he and the 20 Negroes worked together, plastered over with mud against the mosquitoes, and, as Miss Coldfield told Quentin, distinguishable one from another by his beard and eyes alone, and only the architect resembling a human creature because of the French clothes which he wore constantly with a sort of invincible fatality, until the day after the house was completed, save for the window glass and the ironware which they could not make by hand, and the architect departed, working in the sun and heat of summer and the mud and ice of winter, with quiet and unflagging fury. It took him 2 years, he and his crew of imported slaves, which his adopted fellow citizens still looked on as being a good deal more deadly than any beast he could have started and slain in that country. They worked from sunup to sundown, while parties of horsemen rode up and sat their horses quietly and watched, and the architect in his formal coat and his Paris hat and his expression of grim and embittered amazement lurked about the environs of the scene, with his air something between a casual and bitterly disinterested spectator and a condemned and conscientious ghost. Amazement, General Compson said, not at the others and what they were doing so much as at himself, at the inexplicable and incredible fact of his own presence. But he was a good architect. Quentin knew the house 12 miles from Jefferson in its grove of cedar and oak, 75 years after it was finished. And not only an architect, as General Compson said, but an artist, since only an artist could have borne those 2 years in order to build a house which he doubtless not only expected, but firmly intended, never to see again. Not, General Compson said, the hardship to sense and the outrage to sensibility of the 2 years' sojourn, but Sutphen, that only an artist could have borne Sutphen's ruthlessness and hurry and still managed to curb the dream of grim and castle-like magnificence at which Sutphen obviously aimed. Since the place, as Sutphen planned it, would have been almost as large as Jefferson itself at the time, that the little grim-harried foreigner had single-handed given battle to and vanquished Sutphen's fierce and overweening vanity or desire for magnificence or for vindication or whatever it was, even General Compson did not know yet. and so created of Sutpin's very defeat the victory which, in conquering, Sutpin himself would have failed to gain. So it was finished, then, down to the last plank and brick and wooden pin which they could make themselves. Unpainted and unfurnished, without a pane of glass or a doorknob or hinge in it, 12 miles from town and almost that far from any neighbor, it stood for 3 years more, surrounded by its formal gardens and promenades, its slave quarters and stables and smokehouses. Wild turkey ranged within a mile of the house, and deer came light and colored like smoke and left delicate prints in the formal beds where there would be no flowers for 4 years yet. Now there began a period, a phase, during which the town and the county watched him with more puzzlement yet. Perhaps it was because the next step toward that secret end which General Compson claimed to have known, but which the town and the country comprehended but dimly or not at all, now required patience or passive time instead of that driving fury to which he had accustomed them. Now it was the women who first suspected what he wanted, what the next step would be. None of the men, certainly not those who knew him well enough to call him by name, suspected that he wanted a wife. Doubtless there were some of them, husbands and bachelors both, who not only would have refused to entertain the idea, but would even have protested against it, because for the next 3 years he led what must have been to them a perfect existence. He lived out there, 8 miles from any neighbor, in masculine solitude in what might be called the half-acre gunroom of a baronial splendor. He lived in the Spartan shell of the largest edifice in the county, not excepting the courthouse itself, whose threshold no woman had so much as seen, without any feminized softness of window-pane or door or mattress, where there was not only no woman to object if he should elect to have his dogs in to sleep on the pallet bed with him. He did not even need dogs to kill the game which left footprints within sight of the kitchen door, but hunted it instead with human beings who belonged to him body and soul, and of whom it was believed or said that they could creep up to a bedded buck and cut its throat before it could move. It was at this time that he began to invite the parties of men of which Miss Coldfield told Quentin, out to Sutpin's Hundred to camp in blankets in the naked rooms of his embryonic formal opulence. They hunted, and at night played cards and drank, and on occasion he doubtless pitted his negroes against one another, and perhaps even at this time participated now and then himself. That spectacle which, according to Miss Coldfield, his son was unable to bear the sight of while his daughter looked on unmoved. Sutpin drank himself now, though there were probably others beside Quentin's grandfather who remarked that he drank very sparingly, save when he himself had managed to supply some of the liquor. His guests would bring whiskey out with them, but he drank of this with a sort of sparing calculation, as though keeping mentally, General Compson said, a sort of balance of spiritual solvency between the amount of whiskey he accepted and the amount of running meat which he supplied to the guns. He lived like that for 3 years. He now had a plantation. Inside of 2 years he had dragged house and gardens out of virgin swamp and plowed and planted his land with seed cotton which General Compson loaned him. Then he seemed to quit. He seemed to just sit down in the middle of what he had almost finished and to remain so for 3 years, during which he did not even appear to intend or want anything more. Perhaps it is not to be wondered at that the men in the county came to believe that the life he now led had been his aim all the time. It was General Compson, who seemed to have known him well enough to offer to lend him seed cotton for his start, who knew any better, to whom Sutpin never told anything about his past. It was General Compson who knew first about the Spanish coin being his last one. As it was Compson, so the town learned later, who offered to lend Sutpin the money to finish and furnish his house and was refused. So doubtless General Compson was the first man in the county to tell himself that Sutpin did not need to borrow money with which to complete the house, supply what it yet lacked, because he intended to marry it. Not the first person, the first man, since, according to what Miss Coldfield told Quentin 75 years later, the women in the county had been telling one another and their husbands as well that Sutpin did not intend to quit there, that he had already gone to too much trouble, gone through too much privation and hardship, to settle down and live exactly as he had lived while the house was being built, save that now he had a roof to sleep under in place of an unfloored wagon hood. Probably the women had already cast about among the families of the men who might now be called his friends, for that prospective bride whose dowry might complete the shape and substance of that respectability Miss Coldfield, anyway, believed to be his aim. So when, at the expiration of this second phase, 3 years after the house was finished and the architect departed, and again on Sunday morning and again without warning, the town saw him cross the square, on foot now but in the same garments in which he had ridden into town 5 years ago, and which no one had seen since, he or one of the negroes had ironed the coat with heated bricks, General Compson told Quentin's father, and entered the Methodist church, only some of the men were surprised. The women merely said that he had exhausted the possibilities of the families of the men with whom he had hunted and gambled, and that he had now come to town to find a wife exactly as he would have gone to the Memphis market to buy livestock or slaves. But when they comprehended whom it was that he had apparently come to town and into church to invest with his choice, the assurance of the women became one with the men's surprise, and then even more than that, amazement. Because the town now believed that it knew him. For 2 years it had watched him, as with that grim and unflagging fury he had erected that shell of a house and laid out his fields. Then for 3 years he had remained completely static, as if he were run by electricity and someone had come along and removed, dismantled, the wiring or the dynamo, while the women of the county gradually convinced it that he was merely waiting to find a wife with a dowry to finish it with. So that when he entered the Methodist church that Sunday morning in his ironed coat, there were men as well as women who believed that they had only to look around the congregation in order to anticipate the direction his feet would take him. Until they became aware that he had apparently marked down Miss Coldfield's father with the same cold and ruthless deliberation with which he had probably marked down the French architect. They watched in shocked amazement while he laid deliberate siege to the one man in the town with whom he could have had nothing in common, least of all money, a man who obviously could do nothing under the sun for him save give him credit at a little crossroads store or cast a vote in his favor if he should ever seek ordination as a Methodist minister. A Methodist steward, a merchant, not only of modest position and circumstances, but who already had a wife and family of his own, let alone a dependent mother and sister, to support out of the proceeds of a business which he had brought to Jefferson 10 years ago in a single wagon. A man with a name for absolute and undeviating and even Puritan uprightness in a country and time of lawless opportunity, who neither drank nor gambled nor even hunted. In their surprise, they forgot that Mr. Coldfield had a marriageable daughter. They did not consider the daughter at all. They did not think of love in connection with Sutphen. They thought of ruthlessness rather than justice, and of fear rather than respect, but not of pity or love. Besides being too lost in amazed speculation as to just how Sutphen intended or could contrive to use Mr. Coldfield to further whatever secret ends he still had. They were never to know. Even Miss Rosa Coldfield did not, because from that day there were no more hunting parties out at Sutphen's Hundred, and when they saw him now it would be in town. But not loafing, idling. The men who had slept and matched glasses with him under his roof, some of them had even come to call him Sutphen without the formal mister, watched him pass along the street before the Holston house with a single formal gesture to his hat and go on and enter Mr. Coldfield's store. And that was all. Then one day he quitted Jefferson for the second time, Mr. Compson told Quentin. The town should have been accustomed to that by now. Nevertheless, his position had subtly changed, as you will see by the town's reaction to this second return. Because when he came back this time, he was in a sense a public enemy. Perhaps this was because of what he brought back with him this time, the material he brought back this time, as compared to the simple wagon load of wild niggers which he had brought back before. But I don't think so. That is, I think it was a little more involved than the sheer value of his chandeliers and mahogany and rugs. I think that the affront was born of the town's realization that he was getting it involved with himself, that whatever the felony which produced the mahogany and crystal, he was forcing the town to compound it. Heretofore, until that Sunday when he came to church, if he had misused or injured anybody, it was only old Ichimotubi, from whom he got his land, a matter between his conscience and Uncle Sam and God. But now his position had changed, because when, about 3 months after he departed, 4 wagons left Jefferson to go to the river and meet him, it was known that Mr. Coldfield was the man who hired and dispatched them. They were big wagons drawn by oxen, and when they returned, the town looked at them and knew, no matter what they might have contained, that Mr. Coldfield could not have mortgaged everything that he owned for enough to fill them. Doubtless this time there were more men than women even who pictured him during this absence with a handkerchief over his face and the two pistol barrels glinting beneath the candelabra of a steamboat saloon, even if no worse. If not something performed in the lurking dark of a muddy landing and with a knife from behind. They saw him pass on the roan horse beside his four wagons. It seems that even the ones who had eaten his food and shot his game and even called him Sutpen without the mister didn't accost him now. They just waited while reports and rumors came back to town of how he and his now somewhat tamed negroes had installed the windows and doors and the spits and pots in the kitchen and the crystal chandeliers in the parlors and the furniture and the curtains and the rugs. It was that same Akers who had blundered onto the mud-couched negro 5 years ago, who came, a little wild-eyed and considerably slack-mouthed, into the Holston House bar one evening, and said, "Boys, this time he stole the whole dern steamboat." So at last civic virtue came to a boil.
This book is continued on Disc 2.
So at last civic virtue came to a boil. One day, and with the sheriff of the county among them, a party of 8 or 10 took the road out to Sutpen's Hundred. They did not go all the way, because about 6 miles from town they met Sutpen himself. He was riding the roan horse, in the frock coat and the beaver hat which they knew, and with his legs wrapped in a piece of tarpaulin. He had a portmanteau on his pommel, and he was carrying a small woven basket on his arm. He stopped the roan. It was April then, and the road was still a quagmire, and sat there in his splashed tarpaulin and looked from one face to the next. Your grandfather said that his eyes looked like pieces of a broken plate, and that his beard was strong as a currycomb. That was how he put it, strong as a currycomb. "Good morning, gentlemen," he said. "Were you looking for me?" Doubtless something more than this transpired at the time, though none of the Vigilance Committee ever told it that I know of. All I ever heard is how the town, the men on the gallery of the Holston House, saw Sutpen and the committee ride onto the square together, Sutpen a little in front and the others bunched behind him, Sutpen with his legs and feet wrapped neatly in his tarpaulin, and his shoulders squared inside the worn broadcloth coat, and that worn, brushed beaver cocked a little, talking to them over his shoulder, and those eyes hard and pale and reckless, and probably quizzical and maybe contemptuous even then. He pulled up at the door, and the negro hostler ducked out and took the roan's head, and Sutpen got down with his portmanteau and the basket, and mounted the steps, and I heard how he turned there and looked at them again where they huddled on their horses, not knowing what to do exactly. And it might have been a good thing that he had that beard, and they could not see his mouth. Then he turned, and he looked at the other men sitting with their feet on the railing and watching him too, men who used to come out to his place and sleep on the floor and hunt with him. And he saluted them with that florid swagger and gesture to the hat. Yes, he was underbred. It showed like this always, your grandfather said, in all his formal contacts with people. He was like John L. Sullivan, having taught himself painfully and tediously to do the shottish, having drilled himself and drilled himself in secret until he now believed it no longer necessary to count the music's beat, say. He may have believed that your grandfather or Judge Benbow might have done it a little more effortlessly than he, but he would not have believed that anyone could have beat him in knowing when to do it and how. And besides, it was in his face. That was where his power lay, your grandfather said. That anyone could look at him and say, given the occasion and the need, this man can and will do anything. And went on into the house and commanded a chamber. So they sat on their horses and waited for him. I suppose they knew that he would have to come out sometime. I suppose they sat there and thought about those two pistols. Because there was still no warrant for him, you see. It was just public opinion in an acute state of indigestion. And now other horsemen rode into the square and became aware of the situation, so that there was quite a posse waiting when he walked out onto the gallery. He wore a new hat now and a new broadcloth coat, so they knew what the portmanteau had contained. They even knew now what the basket had contained, because he did not have that with him now either, though doubtless at the time it merely puzzled them more than ever. Because, you see, they had been too busy speculating on just how he was planning to use Mr. Coldfield, and, since his return, too completely outraged by the belief that they now saw the results, even if the means were still an enigma, to remember about Miss Ellen at all. So he stopped again, doubtless, and looked from face to face again, doubtless memorizing the new faces, without any haste, with still the beard to hide whatever his mouth might have shown. But he seems to have said nothing at all this time. He just ascended the steps and walked on across the square. The committee, your grandfather said it had grown to almost 50 by now, moving too, following him across the square. They say he did not even look back. He just walked on, erect, with the new hat cocked and carrying in his hand now that which must have seemed to them the final gratuitous bafflement and even insult. With the committee riding along in the street beside him and not quite parallel, and others who did not happen to have horses at the moment joining in and following the committee in the road, and ladies and children and women slaves coming to the doors and windows of the homes as they passed, to watch as they went on in grim tableau, and Sutphen, still without once looking back, entered Mr. Coldfield's gate and strode on up the brick walk to the door, carrying his newspaper cornucopia of flowers. They waited for him again. The crowd was growing fast now. Other men and a few boys and even some negroes from the adjacent houses, plotting behind the 8 original members of the committee, who sat watching Mr. Coldfield's door until he emerged. It was a good while, and he no longer carried the flowers, and when he returned to the gate, he was engaged to be married. But they did not know this, because as soon as he reached the gate, they arrested him. They took him back to town, with the ladies and children and house niggers watching from behind curtains and behind the shrubbery in the yards and the corners of the houses, the kitchens where doubtless food was already beginning to scorch, and so back to the square, where the rest of the able-bodied men left their offices and stores to follow, so that when he reached the courthouse, Sutphen had a larger following than if he actually had been the runaway slave. They arraigned him before a justice, but by that time your grandfather and Mr. Coldfield had got there. They signed his bond, and late that afternoon he returned home with Mr. Coldfield, walking along the same street as of the forenoon, with doubtless the same faces watching him from behind the window curtains, to the betrothal supper, with no wine at table and no whiskey before or after. I've heard how during none of his 3 passages that day through that street did his bearing alter. The same unhurried stride to which that new frock coat swung, the same angle to the new hat above the eyes and the beard. Your grandfather said that some of the faience appearance, which the flesh of his face had had when he came to town 5 years ago, was gone now, and that his face had an honest sunburn. And he was not fleshier, either. Your grandfather said that was not it. It was just that the flesh on his bones had become quieter, as though passive after some actual breasting of atmosphere, like in running, so that he actually filled his clothes now, with that quality still swaggering but without braggadocio or belligerence, though according to your grandfather the quality had never been belligerence, only watchfulness. And now that was gone, as though after the 3 years he could trust his eyes alone to do the watching, without the flesh on his bones standing sentry also. 2 months later he and Miss Ellen were married. It was in June of 1838, almost 5 years to the day from that Sunday morning when he rode into town on the roan horse. It, the wedding, was in the same Methodist church where he saw Ellen for the first time, according to Miss Rosa. The aunt had even forced or nagged, not cajoled, that would not have done it, Mr. Coldfield into allowing Ellen to wear powder on her face for the occasion. The powder was to hide the marks of tears. But before the wedding was over, the powder was streaked again, caked and channeled. Ellen seems to have entered the church that night out of weeping as though out of rain, gone through the ceremony and then walked back out of the church and into the weeping again, the tears again, the same tears even, the same rain. She got into the carriage and departed in it, the rain, for Sutphen's Hundred. It was the wedding which caused the tears, not Mary and Sutphen. Whatever tears there were for that, granted there were tears, came later. It was not intended to be a big wedding. That is, Mr. Coldfield seems not to have intended it to be. Of the two men, I don't speak of Ellen, of course. In fact, you will notice that most divorces occur with women who were married by tobacco-chewing J.P.s in country courthouses, or by ministers waked after midnight, with their suspenders showing beneath their coattails and no collar on, and a wife or spinster sister in curl papers for witness. So is it too much to believe that these women come to long for divorce from a sense not of incompleteness, but of actual frustration and betrayal? That regardless of the breathing evidence of children and all else, they still have in their minds even yet the image of themselves walking to music and turning heads, in all the symbolical trappings and circumstances of ceremonial surrender of that which they no longer possess? And why not, since to them the actual and authentic surrender can only be, and have been, a ceremony like the breaking of a banknote to buy a ticket for the train? Of the two men, it was Sutphen who desired, or hoped, I have this from something your grandfather let drop one day, and which he doubtless had from Sutphen himself in the same accidental fashion, since Sutphen never even told Ellen that he wanted it, which, the fact that at the last minute he refused to support her and her desire and insistence upon it, accounts partly for the tears. The big wedding, the full church, and all the ritual. Mr. Coldfield apparently intended merely to employ, use, the church, apart from its spiritual significance, exactly as he might or would have used any other object, concrete or abstract, to which he had given a certain amount of his time. He seems to have intended to use the church into which he had invested a certain amount of sacrifice and doubtless self-denial, and certainly actual labor and money, for the sake of what might be called a demand balance of spiritual solvency. Exactly as he would have used a cotton gin in which he considered himself to have incurred either interest or responsibility for the ginning of any cotton which he or any member of his family, by blood or by marriage, had raised. That and no more. Perhaps this was due to the same tedious and unremitting husbandry which had enabled him to support mother and sister and marry and raise a family on the proceeds of that store, which 10 years ago had fitted into a single wagon. Or perhaps it was some innate sense of delicacy and fitness, which his sister and daughter did not seem to possess, by the way, regarding the prospective son-in-law whom just 2 months ago he had been instrumental in getting out of jail. But not from any lack of courage regarding the son-in-law's still anomalous position in the town. Regardless of what their relations before that had been and of what their future relations might be, if Mr. Coldfield had believed Sutphen guilty at the time of any crime, he would not have raised a finger to take Sutphen out. He might not have gone out of his way to keep Sutphen in jail, but doubtless the best possible moral fumigation which Sutphen could have received at the time in the eyes of his fellow citizens was the fact that Mr. Coldfield signed his bond, something he would not have done to save his own good name, even though the arrest had been a direct result of the business between himself and Sutphen. That affair which, when it reached a point where his conscience refused to sanction it, he had withdrawn from and let Sutphen take all the profit, refusing even to allow Sutphen to reimburse him for the loss, which, in withdrawn, he had suffered, though he did permit his daughter to marry this man of whose actions his conscience did not approve. This was the second time he did something like that. When they were married, there were just 10 people in the church, including the wedding party, of the 100 who had been invited. Though when they emerged from the church, it was at night, Sutphen had brought in a half dozen of his wild negroes to wait at the door with burning pine knots. The rest of the 100 were there in the persons of boys and youths and men from the drover's tavern on the edge of town, stock traders and hostlers and such who had not been invited. That was the other half of the reason for Ellen's tears. It was the aunt who persuaded or cajoled Mr. Coldfield into the big wedding. Sutphen had not expressed himself, but he wanted it. In fact, Miss Rosa was righter than she knew. He did want, not the anonymous wife and the anonymous children, but the two names, the stainless wife and the unimpeachable father-in-law, on the license, the patent. Yes, patent, with a gold seal and red ribbons, too, if that had been practicable. But not for himself. She, Miss Rosa, would have called the gold seal and the ribbons vanity. But then, so had vanity conceived that house, and, in a strange place and with little else but his bare hands and further handicapped by the chance and probability of meddling interference arising out of the disapprobation of all communities of men toward any situation which they do not understand, built it. And pride. She admitted to you that he was brave. Perhaps she will even allow him pride. The same pride which wanted such a house, which would accept nothing less, and drove through to get it at whatever cost, and then lived in it, alone, on a pallet on the floor for 3 years until he could furnish it as it should be furnished. Not the least of which furniture was that wedding license. She was quite right. It was not just shelter, not just anonymous wife and children that he wanted, just as he did not want just wedding. But he never told Ellen nor anyone. In fact, when the female crisis came, when Ellen and the aunt tried to enlist him on their side to persuade Mr. Coldfield to the big wedding, he refused to support them. He doubtless remembered even better than Mr. Coldfield that 2 months ago he had been in jail. That public opinion, which at some moment during the 5 preceding years had swallowed him, even though he never had quite ever lain quiet on its stomach, had performed one of mankind's natural and violent and inexplicable volt-faces and regurgitated him. And it did not help him any that at least 2 of the citizens who should have made 2 of the teeth in the outraged jaw served instead as props to hold the jaw open and impotent while he walked out of it unharmed. Ellen and the aunt remembered this, too. The aunt did. Being a woman, she was doubtless one of that league of Jefferson women who, on the second day after the town saw him 5 years ago, had agreed never to forgive him for not having any past, and who had remained consistent. Since the marriage was now a closed incident, she probably looked upon it as the one chance to thrust him back into the gullet of public opinion which had tried at last to refuse him, not only to secure her niece's future as his wife, but to justify the action of her brother in getting him out of jail, and her own position as having apparently sanctioned and permitted the wedding which in reality she could not have prevented. This, as Miss Rosa told you, for the sake of that big house and the position and state which the women realized long before the men did, that he not only aimed at but was going to attain. Or maybe women are even less complex than that. And to them any wedding is better than no wedding, and a big wedding with a villain preferable to a small one with a saint. So the aunt even used Ellen's tears, and Suckman, who probably knew about what was going to happen, becoming as the time drew near graver and graver. Not concerned, just watchful, like he must have been from the day when he turned his back upon all that he knew, the faces and the customs, and he was just 14 then, he told your grandfather, just the same age that Henry was that night in the stable which Miss Rosa told you about, which Henry could not quite stand up to. Set out into a world which, even in theory, the average geographical schoolin' of the normal boy of 14, he knew nothing about, and with a fixed goal in his mind, which most men do not set up until the blood begins to slow at 30 or more, and then only because the image represents peace and indolence, or at least a crowning of vanity, not the vindication of a past affront in the person of a son whose seed is not yet, and would not be for years yet, planted. That same alertness which he had to wear day and night without changing or laying aside, like the clothing which, without doubt and for a time at least, he had to sleep in as well as live in, and in a country and among a people whose very language he had to learn, and where because of this he was able to make that mistake which, if he had acquiesced to it, would not even have been an error, and which, since he refused to accept it or be stopped by it, became his doom. That unsleeping care which must have known that it could permit itself but one mistake. That alertness for measuring and weighing event against eventuality, circumstance against human nature, his own fallible judgment and mortal clay, against not only human but natural forces, choosin' and discardin', compromisin' with his dream and his ambition, like you must with the horse which you take across country over timber, which you control only through your ability to keep the animal from realizing that actually you cannot, that actually it is the stronger. His was the curious position now. His was the solitary one, not Ellen. She not only had the aunt to support her, but the fact that women never plead nor claim loneliness until impenetrable and insurmountable circumstances forces them to give up all hope of attaining the particular bauble which at the moment they happen to want. And not Mr. Coldfield. He had not only public opinion, but his own disinclination for the big wedding to support it without incongruity or paradox. As Ellen had her aunt as well as her own desire for the big wedding to support it without incongruity or paradox. While Sutphen wanted the big wedding more than Ellen did, or for a deeper reason than she did, yet his judgment forewarned him how the town would take it even more than Mr. Coldfield's did. So while Ellen was using her tears not only to coerce her father but to persuade Sutphen to put his weight into the balance on her side, he had but one enemy, Mr. Coldfield. But when he refused her, when he remained neutral, he had three, counting the aunt. Then, the tears won, Ellen and the aunt wrote out 100 invitations. Sutphen brought in one of the wild negroes who carried them from door to door by hand, and even sent out 12 more personal ones for the dress rehearsal. When they reached the church for the rehearsal on the night before the wedding and found the church itself empty, and a handful of men from the town's purlieus, including 2 of old Ichamatubi's Chickasaws, standing in the shadows outside the door, the tears came down again. Ellen went through the rehearsal, but afterward the aunt took her home in a state very near hysteria, though by the next day it had become just quiet, intermittent weeping again. There was some talk even of putting the wedding off. I don't know who it came from, perhaps from Sutphen, but I know who vetoed it. It was as though the aunt were now bent, no longer on merely thrusting Sutphen down the town's throat, but thrusting the wedding itself. She spent all the next day going from house to house, the invitation list in her hand, in a house dress and a shawl, and one of the Coldfield negroes, they were both women, following her, perhaps for protection, perhaps just sucked along like a leaf in the wake of that grim virago fury of female affront. Yes, she came to our house, though your grandfather had never intended anything else but to attend the wedding. The aunt must have had no doubts about father, since father had helped take Sutphen out of jail, though she was probably past all ratiocination by then. She came to our house, too. Father and your grandmother were just married then, and mother was a stranger in Jefferson, and I don't know what she thought except that she would never talk about what happened. About the mad woman whom she had never seen before, who came bursting into the house, not to invite her to a wedding, but to dare her not to come, and then rushed out again. Mother could not even tell what wedding she meant at first, and when father came home he found mother in hysterics too, and even 20 years later mother could not tell what actually happened. There was nothing comic in it to her. Father used to tease her about it, but even 20 years after that day, when he would tease her, I have seen her begin to raise her hand, perhaps with the thimble on one finger, as though to protect herself, and the same look come into her face that must have been there when Ellen's aunt departed. She covered the town that morning. It did not take her long, and it was complete. By nightfall the circumstances of the situation had spread not only beyond the town, but beneath it, penetrating the livery stable and the drover's tavern which was to supply the guests who did attend it, not only as notice, but as a blanket threat and dare. Ellen, of course, was not aware of this, any more than the aunt herself was, or would have believed what was going to happen even if she had been clairvoyant, could actually have seen the rehearsal of events before time produced them. Not that the aunt would have considered herself insulated against being thus affronted. She simply could not have believed that her intentions and actions of the day could have any result other than the one for which she had surrendered for the time not only all Coldfield dignity but all female modesty as well. Sutphen, I suppose, could have told her, but doubtless he knew that the aunt would not have believed him. Probably he did not even try. He just did the only thing he could do, which was to send out to Sutphen's 100 and bring in 6 or 7 more of his Negroes, men on whom he could depend, the only men on whom he could depend, and arm them with the lighted pine knots which they were holding at the door when the carriage came up and the wedding party got out. And this is where the tears stopped, because now the street before the church was lined with carriages and buggies. Though only Sutphen and possibly Mr. Coldfield remarked that instead of being drawn up before the door and empty, they were halted across the street and still occupied, and that now the banquet before the church door was a sort of arena lighted by the smoke and torches which the Negroes held above their heads, the light of which wavered and gleamed upon the 2 lines of faces between which the party would have to pass to enter the church. There were no catcalls yet, no jeering. Evidently, neither Ellen nor the aunt suspected that anything was wrong. Because for the time, Ellen even walked out of the weeping, the tears, and so into the church. It was empty yet, save for your grandfather and grandmother, and perhaps a 6 more who might have come out of loyalty to the Coldfields, or perhaps to be close and so miss nothing of that which the town, as represented by the waiting carriages, seemed to have anticipated as well as Sutphen did. It was still empty even after the ceremony started and concluded. Because Ellen had something of pride, too, or at least that vanity which at times can assume the office of pride and fortitude. Besides, nothing had happened yet. The crowd outside was quiet yet, perhaps out of respect for the church, out of that aptitude and eagerness of the Anglo-Saxon for complete mystical acceptance of immolated sticks and stones. She seems to have walked out of the church and so into it without any warning whatever. Perhaps she was still moving beneath that pride which would not allow the people inside the church to see her weep. She just walked into it, probably hurrying toward the seclusion of the carriage where she could weep. Perhaps her first intimation was the voice shouting, "Look out, don't hit her now!" And then the object, dirt, filth, whatever it was, passing her, or perhaps the change in light itself as she turned and saw one of the Negroes, his torch raised and in the act of springing toward the crowd, the faces, when Sutphen spoke to him in that tongue which even now a good part of the county did not know was a civilized language. That was what she saw, what the others saw from the halted carriages across the street, the bride shrinking into the shelter of his arm as he drew her behind him, and he standing there, not moving even after another object. They threw nothing which could actually injure, it was only clods of dirt and vegetable refuse, struck the hat from his head, and a third struck him full in the chest, standing there motionless, with an expression almost of smiling where his teeth showed through the beard, holding his wild Negroes with that one word. There were doubtless pistols in the crowd, certainly knives. The Negro would not have lived 10 seconds if he had sprung. While about the wedding party the circle of faces with open mouths and torch-reflecting eyes seemed to advance and waver and shift and vanish in the smoky glare of the burning pine. He retreated to the carriage, shielding the 2 women with his body, ordering the Negroes to follow with another word. But they threw nothing else. Apparently it was that first spontaneous outburst, though they had come armed and prepared with the ones they did throw. In fact, that seemed to have been the entire business which had come to a head when the Vigilance Committee followed him to Mr. Coldfield's gate that day 2 months before. Because the men who had composed the mob, the traders and drovers and teamsters, returned, vanished back into the region from which they had emerged for this one occasion like rats, scattered, departed about the country, faces which even Ellen was not to remember, seen for the night or the meal or just the drink at other taverns, 20 and 50 and 100 miles further on along nameless roads, and then gone from there too. And those who had come in the carriages and buggies to see a Roman holiday, driving out to Sutphen's 100 to call, and the men to hunt his game and eat his food again, and on occasion gathering at night in his stable, while he matched 2 of his wild Negroes against one another as men match game cocks, or perhaps even entered the ring himself. It blew away, though not out of memory. He did not forget that night, even though Ellen, I think, did, since she washed it out of her remembering with tears. Yes, she was weeping again now. It did indeed rain on that marriage.